This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We've got record heat from top to bottom of the middle of the country. Those are just a couple of the spots that we're going to focus on. But let's start with Texas, where temperatures today expected to hit 103 degrees in Austin. That would break that record for this date of 98 degrees. Similar story in Houston, not quite as expansive between today's temperatures that we're expecting in the record, but still likely to break a record there. Del Rio and more of where that came from as we get into tomorrow, too. 99 for Dallas, 105 for Austin. Fort Smith potentially tying a record. Even out towards Monroe, maybe not record-breaking temperatures, but we sure are close, and we sure are running well above normal for this time of year. When it's all said and done through the week, I think we'll see dozens of potential records challenged. You can see many of them focused across the southern plains, but Kansas City, Rockford, Indianapolis, all included in that as well, where we could see some of those record-breaking highs. Big picture look for the temperatures today. Yes, hot, and of course, summer-like across Texas, but even up into Minneapolis, we're running nearly 20 degrees above normal, so a high of 88 degrees is what you'll get for our friends there. 70s for Detroit, mid-80s for Kansas City. Even tomorrow, 93 degrees in Wichita. Jackson will head to the low 90s.
Texas, summer heat wave in early spring, like 112 degrees Fahrenheit and 115 in Mexico. That's 44 to 46 C. It was not much cooler up north. Temperatures hit 100 degrees Fahrenheit in North Dakota and northern Minnesota, with tropical nights, which you define as above 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 C. Huge wildfires erupted in Minnesota and just across the border.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. We begin tonight with the raging wildfires in Manitoba. Premier Wab Kanew has declared a state of emergency in the southern Whiteshell area near the Ontario border. The local provincial park has been closed ahead of the busy long weekend. There are 21 active fires across the province, including an out-of-control blaze in the regional municipality of Lac-du-Bonny. Sue and Richard Nowell died trying to flee that fire. Nearly 1,000 residents have had to leave their homes. 40 firefighters from BC have arrived to help, but officials say they need at least 80 more.
We've had 80 fires to date, and the 20-year average number of fires to date is 48. So you can see that as of today, we are well above average for this time of year.
All this in the middle of May. Winnipeg was 96.8 in the shade, 36C. This is all crazy stuff, but never mind that global warming. We have pipelines to build. It's jobs and money while the house burns down. Professor Elliot Jacobson points out May 9th, 2025 was the hottest May 9th on record globally, with daily records dating back to 1940. And yes, that means that May 9th, 2025 was likely the hottest May 9th in the last 120,000 plus years. May 10th was the hottest May 10th during all human existence, probably. Just the facts. Even stranger, the weather could switch from sizzling hot to snow in a couple of days. Is it just me, or is that kind of whiplash becoming more common? Scientists noticed, checked it all out, and published the paper, Rapid Flips Between Warm and Cold Extremes in a Warming World. They say, quote, of the global areas defined by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, over 60% have experienced more frequent, intense, and rapid flips since 1961, and this trend will expand to most areas in the future, end quote. Paul Beckwith has a video out on that on YouTube. Find links in my blog at ecoshock.org. Did I mention the strange dry spring in the UK? Along with the worst UK wildfire season on record already by April. And now we have thirst waves, defined as prolonged periods of agriculture exposure to extreme atmospheric evaporative demand for water. They say, quote, not only have thirst waves increased in severity, but the likelihood of no thirst waves occurring during the growing season has significantly decreased, end quote. We all know the rule that a 1 degree C rise in global mean temperature means 7% more water vapor in the air. But hold on, not really. It means 7% more capacity or demand for water in the air. When it's much less than that, the air sucks water from plants and the soil as it passes over. That is a thirst wave. Atmospheric demand for water makes a guest appearance in our next interview. On May 16, 1972, 53 years ago, great American climate pioneers like Charles Keeling and Wally Broecker met at the Carbon and the Biosphere Symposium held in New York State. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere then was about 327 parts per million. Here in 2025, that became 430 parts per million. More than 100 parts per million, more carbon dioxide up there in just 50 years. That isn't safe for anybody. We have to cope. In our second half hour, a comprehensive new study finds the best ways to cool down cities. We really need that. Dr. Scott Krayenhoff talks to us about cooler cities. But first we explore the dragon. Can the world feed itself as we heat up the planet? There are some surprises here. But when crops go bad, society can go off the rails. Will climate change damage key crops like wheat, soybeans, or rice? Has it already reduced yields? That is part of the life work of Dr. David Lobel. David is professor at Stanford University in the Department of Earth System Science and director of the Center on Food Security and the Environment. Lobel received the MacArthur Genius Award and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. With co-author Stefania Di Tommaso, Lobel just published a major review of climate impacts on food production. Published in April 2025 in PNAS, the title is A Half Century of Climate Change in Major Agricultural Regions, Trends, Impacts, and Surprises. We all eat, we all need to know. David Lobel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Does farming depend on the weather or on the climate?
Well, farming will depend on the weather, but the weather will depend on the climate. So I guess it depends on both.
All right. Now, while others created models to predict future food production in a changing climate, you looked back. Why?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is we want to know if these models are trustworthy, and so we want to look at how they've done historically. That's probably the main reason. But I think there's also questions around whether some of the stresses we see on the food system now, at least in part, are because of climate changes that are already happening. And then the third reason, which is also quite important, I think, is to understand not just if climate is affecting agriculture, but specifically where and how, so that efforts to adapt to climate change, for example, if you're trying to breed new crops, you can focus on the aspects of climate that are most changing most quickly.
And you find most agricultural regions are experiencing rapid warming. What does that look like? Could you give us an example?
Sure. I think it shouldn't be surprising, I think, in 2025 that most farmers around the world are experiencing change. But what we wanted to do was quantify just how fast that change was, and also, like, how many aspects of climate does that refer to. So, for example, if you take Europe as an example, they've been warming very rapidly, but the rainfall hasn't really been changing very much, at least over the 50-year time period. And in addition to those changes, they've had a decrease in the humidity of the air. And all three of those factors matter for crops. And what we see is that, for example, the coolest seasons right now in Europe are actually warmer than the warmer seasons that we saw 50 years ago.
Well, looking at 50 years of records, all sorts of data, you find, for example, wheat production is 10% lower than it would have been without climate changes during that time. But wheat productivity has soared, some say tripled, since the 1960s. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy. There's a lot of things going on. Some are positive and some are not positive. I think the overwhelming effect of technology in the last 50 years is the main thing that you see. But the counterfactual, in other words, if we hadn't had climate change, would have been that we would have had even higher yields.
And critics say plants will grow better in a warmer world, especially with more carbon dioxide in the air. It's kind of like a food for them. You investigated that. Is it partly true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's always been acknowledged. I think for some people it gets emphasized maybe too much and some maybe too little. But there are definitely parts of the world, and we see that, where the warming is not a bad thing or it could even be a good thing. And then certainly the CO2 increases are positive. So with food, we're always looking at the balance of positives and negatives, both in terms of different elements of the climate system in the same location. Some may have positive effects, like CO2 going up. Some may have negative effects, like temperatures rising. But also in terms of geography. So some areas may be benefiting on net, and some areas may be losing. And so when we say something like 10% loss of yield, that's sort of averaging over the entire world, including some areas that are getting hit much harder than that and some that are actually benefiting.
And speaking of that, will agriculture in temperate zones be more damaged by climate changes than in the tropics?
It's hard to say in terms of the crop productivity. It's hard to say that the temperate system overall will be more or less damaged. I think it's certainly true that very high latitude areas, if you look at, for example, Canada or northern China, those will tend to benefit. But if you look at like the Midwest of the U.S. or most of Europe or much of South America, those temperate areas will not be benefiting. And then tropics, it's also a little bit of a mixed bag, but in general, the tropical areas get hurt. Whether they get hurt more or less than temperate areas, it really depends, I think, on the crop and the country.
So wheat is a staple in many parts of the world. Give us our daily bread, is the saying. Does your review suggest there is more threat to wheat in a warming world than, say, for rice?
Yes, and this is not, I would say, surprising in terms of the literature. The effects on wheat and barley, those are two major crops in the world that are primarily cool season crops. They're grown in either summers in cool locations or winters in most locations. They don't like warm temperatures, those crops. They don't do well relative to cooler. And rice, in contrast, evolves in a more tropical setting, does quite well as long as it has water in warm conditions. Of course, getting too warm, especially at night, is not a good thing. And so we don't see like big benefits for rice. But in relative terms, it does better than wheat.
You begin the paper with a question: will climate change compromise the ability of humanity to feed itself? Well, a lot of our listeners have been asking themselves that same question. What do you think?
Yeah, this was a motivating question. It wasn't necessarily I was going to provide a definitive answer. I think it increases the challenge of feeding ourselves. I don't see a scenario where climate change is so overwhelming that we can't deal with it, but it certainly is big enough that it's going to take many billions of dollars of effort to try to adapt our system, to try to improve the productivity that we wouldn't have otherwise needed without climate change.
Well, it's super important to have some sort of crop forecasts. A lot of things depend on that, even parts of the financial industry. So scientists in many fields have tried to model out agricultural future. And when you compared the actual data over decades to previous model predictions, how did they do?
Yeah, that was one of the main goals we had. And I would say that overall, it did quite well. If you look at all the different countries, all the different variables that we're interested in for agriculture, so we looked across like the main producing areas, the main crops, the main seasons. The climate models were remarkably good at telling us kind of which areas should warm the most, where the humidity would be going down, where the humidity would be stable, where rainfall would be going down, where rainfall would be going up or staying the same. Really, region after region, the models were quite reliable. If you had like gone back in time 50 years ago and run these models forward with the greenhouse gas emissions, they would have done actually a very good job of guiding our understanding of what's going to change and how fast it would change. So I would say overall it did quite well, and there were two big misses, and those misses are important, and we emphasize them in the paper because of wanting to help modelers focus in where they need to improve. But, you know, I would say that at worst they get an A- in terms of their ability, and it is quite, you know, hard to get all these things right. For example, India is a country, hugely important for food security as other regions and wouldn't have a humidity decrease like some other regions. And in fact, that's what the observations bore out, that because of where it is in the world, where it is in sort of the climate system, that's the changes that you would expect. So overall, quite well. A couple surprises. We can get into those more. But yeah, I would say that overall, the models proved pretty good.
Well, one of the surprises for me in the paper, despite dramatic warming for crops in many countries, you find the United States and Canada are like an exception. There is even talk of a U.S. warming hole. Could you talk us through that, David?
Yeah, this has been something that climate scientists have observed for a while. There's this bit of a puzzle that despite the amount of warming we see in other seasons, like in winter, and despite the amount of summer warming we see in most parts of even the U.S., but especially the world, the eastern part of the U.S., where we grow most of our grains, in the summer months, and even to some degree in late spring, have not shown a very significant change in temperatures over the last 50 years. And when you look at this in the relative context of warming all around it, if you plot a map of temperature change or warming over the last 50 years, it kind of has this bullseye around the eastern U.S., which people have referred to as the warming hole, because there's a lack of warming there. So this is a well-known thing in climate science as well. It's a well-known phenomenon. It's not necessarily well explained. People have different hypotheses about what's going on there. What we do in this study is show that in the world of agriculture, all of the growing regions of the world, this is one of the big standouts where the models and the data don't agree historically. And it's been to the benefit of U.S. agriculture in the sense that if it had been warming as the rest of the world, we would have seen much more pressure on the productivity of corn and soybeans and wheat in this country.
Of course, the disadvantage is it might delay climate action in North America if the impacts aren't seen while people in other countries suffer. But the other thing, it comes to me, do we know if this warming hole is temporary or could it suddenly catch up to the general warming?
Yeah, that's the big question. I think climate science, unfortunately, and to their credit, they don't, I think as a whole, they have a very active debate going on. Nobody is claiming to know for sure. I think it's most likely going to be a couple of factors that are driving it. Some of those factors we actually think will persist into the future. It's related to kind of the relative warming rates of different parts of the ocean and the land. But some of it is just, I think, good luck over the last few decades. And so in that sense, we would expect it to revert back to what the rest of the world has seen. I think you're absolutely right that the potential downside of this reprieve is that farmers and policymakers in the U.S. maybe underappreciate just how rapid things can change. And if I travel around the world, when I do travel around the world and talk to farmers and other people in agriculture in other countries, and you ask, have you noticed changes in climate? They look at you kind of like you're asking a very dumb question. Of course they've seen changes. Of course they think we should do something if we can. Whereas farmers in the U.S., they'll often be unconvinced that climate change is really a problem. And that, I think, it directly relates to their personal experience.
Another almost surprise for many people would be watching triple-digit heat waves. We might think extreme heat is killing crops, but you found a more serious threat tied into that. What is vapor pressure deficit, and why is that important to food production as the world warms?
So vapor pressure deficit is a measure of how dry the air is relative to how much water it could hold. So anyone who's been to, say, Florida versus Arizona understands that a 100-degree day in Florida feels very different than a 100-degree in Arizona. And that's because the humidity of the air in Arizona is much lower. And what that means is that the air has much higher vapor pressure deficit in Arizona than in Florida. As a human, that can actually help to cool your body because you have a lot of basically evaporation of sweat from your skin that helps to cool you. With crops, a challenge with high VPD is similar thing, but that sweating of the crops or the evaporation of the water from the leaves and what we call transpiration through the pores of the leaves, that helps to keep them cool, but it really uses up a lot of water very quickly. And so one thing we've learned in the last decade in this field is that you can't just look at temperatures if you want to understand fully the impacts. You have to look at the combination of temperature and humidity. So what we did in the study was look at that and found that in some areas where it's warming, actually the vapor pressure deficit isn't going up that much because humidity has been pretty stable or even rising. But in other places, you have warming going up and the humidity actually going down, and vapor pressure deficit therefore goes up very fast. And that can mean that water stress sets much more quickly in farms than it would otherwise. So that's a big concern. It's one that we see, especially in temperate regions. So that, before you were asking about tropics versus temperate, one of the reasons that I wouldn't just say tropical areas are more hurt by heat, because you would think they start off warmer, they would be closer to, you know, temperatures that might damage them, is that the tropics have the benefit of more humidity. And in the temperate systems that are less humid to begin with and that are becoming even less humid over time, the water stress potential is much higher.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist David LaBelle. He has new work on climate damage to crops. When did your study period end? Did it include the large extreme heat waves since 2021 and the seeming jump in global warming in the last 2 years? And if not, would that change the result?
The study goes up to 2023. I would be surprised if any single year would influence things that much. Again, because we look at individual locations, but the statements that you referred to in terms of overall trends and overall impacts are really at the global level. So it's hard to have much of an influence in one single year on these global averages.
Well, as you said, some countries think global warming might be good for them. Russia claimed that about their country. It could expand agricultural zones into Siberia. Are there national winners and losers in this climate lottery when it comes to food production?
I think there will be winners and losers. Whether we can say right now with confidence who those winners and losers will be is, I think, less of a sure thing. It's probably true that when you get to really cold places like Siberia, for example, they are not going to be the most hurt by warming. I think that's pretty clear. In fact, one of the first scientists, Arrhenius, who really articulated the concern about emissions of greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning leading to warming, he actually wasn't that concerned being in Sweden. He thought that this would be a net benefit for agriculture and other things. And that's probably still true for most of Sweden. But countries like China, for example, I think have over time, initially they thought, well, we have a lot of cold areas, this might be beneficial for us. But then you start to realize, well, there's other risks associated besides just the warming. There's other changes going on in climate. And then there's also plenty of places that the warming itself can be damaging, even if you don't traditionally think of the area as an area that's too warm. You can still see net damages at lower temperatures than you would have expected. So I would say that China's an example I think of as a country that kind of went from thinking climate change is not a big deal to thinking it is a big deal. Russia, I don't know as much about, but I do think Siberia is just one part of Russia. And there's, you know, most of the grain-growing areas of Russia are in areas that are pretty exposed to these warming trends and also these humidity changes. And if they have almost entirely rain-fed agriculture there, and if those humidity shifts and those warming shifts lower the productivity of the grain belt, at least from an agricultural sense, it's going to be a problem. So apart from some very northern areas, I think it's hard to say that there are countries that are clearly going to be winning.
The late Lester Brown, he was the founder of Worldwatch. He tracked global reserves of key staple crops. Now, Brown suggested rice was already near its tolerance for warming despite breeding efforts. Your study, if I read it correctly, found less climate impact on rice growing areas, and they were partly compensated by increased CO2. Should we worry about rice, which feeds over half the world's people?
Well, any crop that feeds half the world's people, I would worry about. You know, even if it's a low chance of something bad happening, I think you have a responsibility to think hard about what you can do. I think there's a lot of pressure that climate change is place on any system. In rice, I think what we're saying is that the warming that we've seen so far is not enough to really push it over the edge. In some cases, it's beneficial. For example, it helps to grow more crops in a cycle, like more crops per year, because the crop grows a little faster. The CO2 for rice is beneficial, we know, because of the way that it does photosynthesis and the fact that it's growing in many places that are exposed to significantly higher CO2 levels, that's beneficial. The thing that I think most people who study rice in detail would say is that the big challenges for rice with warming is, one, the nighttime temperatures lead to slower growth rates for rice, and two is the rice that deals with a lot of diseases and pests that are going to be and are becoming more challenging. So again, in a relative sense, I'd rather be a rice farmer than a wheat farmer in the overall picture, but I do think that we're not seeing huge benefits for rice, and that's for the warming to date. As you look forward, there still are risks associated with various aspects of the climate. The other thing I should mention here is we kind of took a broad view of a few key climate variables, but by no means did we look at everything. And with rice, flooding is often an issue. We didn't look specifically at flooding. And so there are other aspects of climate that could matter that we just acknowledge is kind of an area that needs more work.
Right. Even rising seas bringing salty water into some of the river deltas that feed a lot of people. Those are the sorts of things. You can't cover everything in one paper. If a dry heat wave hits two or more of the bread baskets, as we call them, do you expect a year of global shortages of staples, say in the next 10 or 20 years? Or would it just be prices going higher and hardship for some farmers?
Well, I think to me those are, in a sense, the same thing. People who think of shortages, I think, often have in their view like a binary scenario where either everyone has enough food or everyone doesn't have food. The world is obviously, you know, more complicated in the sense that markets determine kind of who has enough, who doesn't have enough food. And the productivity going up or down in any year will just push that balance between supply and demand in one direction or the other. So I worry very much about availability and accessibility of food for poor people, even in bumper harvest years, because there's 800 million people in most years that still are not getting enough calories and protein as it is. But when we talk about shocks to the system, we're talking about that number ballooning up because all of the sudden, you know, large swaths of the population are finding themselves without enough food. If you have two major problems in the same year in two different harvest regions, you know, we've seen that to some extent historically. When you get that, you get price increases, the stocks get drawn down, prices rise, you get a lot of social unrest typically. Governments try to do what they can to provide the staples to their people. Tensions rise, and then generally what happens is a lot of farmers around the world see prices high and they plant more area and they clear more land for growing crops. And in that sense, the markets work in that the supply does respond, but it takes time. And in the short term, you do have the risk that people go hungry. So this is not a problem that I think is ever going to completely be solved. We can only just hope to keep doing better and better so that we are more prepared and that we have less exposure to these scenarios where a couple of bad harvests lead to massive shortages.
David Lobel, you authored or co-authored dozens of papers on agriculture and crop estimations. You hold a patent for a method using satellite data to do it. You started using deep learning and AI several years ago. What do you think of AI for crop estimates and climate forecasts now? Any exciting developments?
Yeah, I think we're getting much better at understanding in basically in real time how regions are doing in terms of their production, and beyond that, how individual farms are doing. And we can see, for example, if a heat wave comes through or a drought comes through, we can actually see which farms fare better than others. And we can ask, like, what are they doing that helps them be adapted to the situation? Have they managed their soil differently? Have they grown a different rotation of crops? Have they invested in irrigation or land leveling? Or we can see all sorts of interesting patterns emerge and learn basically from the experience of farmers. The one kind of ubiquitous thing about farming around the world is it's done by thousands and thousands of individuals who are really each in a way running their own experiment. So I think AI helps both in terms of monitoring the situation at the sort of national to global scale, but it also helps in learning from individuals and trying to pick out the lessons that we can learn.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about your work as we wrap up here?
Well, I think the challenge going forward, as I see it, with climate change is less about whether it's going to threaten food supply and more about understanding specifically, you know, what aspects are most concerning and what aspects are most solvable. I think there's a lot of variation in terms of different crops, in terms of different farms, different practices, different regions, lots of differences out there. And I think historically we've just kind of had a very long laundry list of all of the reasons for concern. And I think now those are well established. What this paper is trying to do is step back and say, okay, what are the big changes that are happening that really require like some serious effort to try to remedy? And I think going along with that, it's like trying to think about, okay, then what are the specific solutions? So going from generals to specifics, both on the sort of definition of the problem and the possible solutions, I think will help in terms of actually taking the problem seriously, but also kind of putting the effort where it's going to be most beneficial.
From Stanford, we've been speaking with Professor David Lobel. His latest paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy is A Half Century of Climate Change in Major Agricultural Regions, Trends, Impacts, and Surprises. Find links to follow up in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We know cities will get even hotter. How can we stay comfortable without burning more fossil fuels? A team of experts led by Dr. Timothy Zhang of Pacific Northwest National Lab investigated common cooling ideas, from making roads white to living green roofs. What works best in most climates? We get answers now and a new mantra for urban development with co-author Scott Krayenhoff. Scott is Associate Professor at the University of Guelph School of Environmental Sciences. From Ontario, Canada, Scott Krayenhoff, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with expectations of extreme heat in the three cities in the way that we're going now, and then we'll get to the best solutions. The classic case is Phoenix in the desert heat of Arizona. From your paper, just to throw in a few numbers, in the scenario of 4.5 degrees C of global mean temperature rise, the hottest week of the year in Phoenix would see temperatures going from 109.9 Fahrenheit, that's 43.3 C, to 114 Fahrenheit, which is 45.6 C. Is that the feel-like temperature you were using, or the Universal Thermal Climate Index? What does that temperature mean?
Yeah, the Universal Thermal Climate Index, UTCI, is essentially a measure of the complete heat exposure of an individual. And we're using it to capture all the different ways that the local meteorology or climate affects our felt perception of heat or cold, but in this case, heat. And so we all know from our experience that it's not just air temperature that affects how warm or cool we feel. It's also things like humidity, wind speed, are we in the shade or in the sun? And the one aspect that UTCI also captures, and our models as well in this study also captured, that a lot of folks aren't as aware of, is that the actual temperatures of the surfaces, not just the air, but the surfaces around us actually provide warming or cooling depending on their temperature relative to us. So a quick example of that last piece is if we're standing on a grass field versus if we're standing on a parking lot, an asphalt parking lot in the middle of a sunny day, we're going to get a lot more heat from that warmer asphalt than we would from, say, grass. So that also matters, and these things are all accounted for in the UTCI.
Why did you pick Toronto and Miami as additional case studies?
Even though Phoenix is extremely hot, you know, a city like Miami is very humid, and that presents difficulties for the human physiology in terms of cooling ourselves, because our main cooling mechanism in hot weather is sweating, and our sweat doesn't evaporate as effectively in more humid conditions. That's why we don't feel very comfortable in more humid conditions for an equivalent air temperature. Now, there's been recent research that's come out just in the last few years suggesting that as we go forward into the future, some of these humid cities, and Toronto is, you know, not as humid as Miami, but it still has reasonably humid conditions for periods every summer, that some of these cities that are quite humid are going to face real problems with heat stress and with thermal discomfort and worse from the heat.
How does excess heat make air pollution more deadly, Scott?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very complex question. They're intertwined in multiple ways. I mean, one simple way is that higher air temperatures change the reaction rates, you know, in terms of chemical reactions that form different pollutants, such as ozone. Obviously, our health, you know, if an individual's physiology has to respond to both heat and air, you know, air quality, poor air quality at the same time, that's going to prevent, cause complications in terms of our body's ability to respond to either one, because there's this, you know, it has to respond to two things at once. So that's getting a little bit beyond my area of expertise, but that's a very important consideration, is to consider both of these factors.
All right. So before we get into your solutions that were examined, how serious are the challenges of urban heat as global warming proceeds?
I think they're very considerable. Already heat and cold temperature effectively is, you know, of all natural hazards is the, you know, causes the most mortality and death worldwide and in North America. And, you know, that's only going to get worse. I mean, if you can look at in the Pacific Northwest in 2021, the extreme heat there caused hundreds and hundreds of deaths, premature deaths. We're headed towards conditions where that's going to become a, not necessarily the deaths, because there's a lot we can do about it, but in terms of that level of extreme heat in the coming decades is going to become more commonplace, very likely.
Okay, now, the biggest discovery in this new paper, from my perspective, is the winning benefit of street trees. Talk to us about the positive role for them in this new, hotter future.
I mean, there's a variety of considerations in terms of street trees in a hotter future, some of which we didn't cover in the paper, and I'll just mention them briefly. For example, how well are they going to survive in these future conditions, and which species might survive better in these warmer future conditions? So trees, I mean, they're not the only thing that provides shade in a city, but they're one of the, you know, they obviously have a whole other range co-benefits beyond reducing heat. But as I was mentioning when I spoke about the UTCI at the start of this episode, one of the key factors in terms of how warm or cool we feel is the radiant environment, and in particular, are we in the shade or not? And so trees obviously provide shade, and so they're, you know, in my view, one of the key factors, you know, trees shouldn't be planted everywhere in the city. I'm by no means saying plant trees everywhere in the city and they're the be-all, end-all, but they're a very important contributor to improving outdoor thermal comfort in the city. And as we all know, I think most of us experience, the more time we spend outdoors, that's a positive predictor of health outcomes. And so the more we can keep our outdoor urban environments reasonably comfortable, the better. And trees can play a major role in that. Now, of course, there's other things that can provide shade. Obviously, just our buildings in cities provide shade. We can also, you know, use awnings and other what we call gray infrastructure, so non-vegetated infrastructure, to provide shade as well.
It's amazing what trees can do, though. In 2018, I spoke with Professor Matt Santamoris. He was in Australia at the time, and he launched a drone that measured 158 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 70 degrees C, on the upper level of a car park in Darwin. And people said it felt like a river of fire at that time. And just below that, at ground level, under a tree, the temperature was measured almost 30 degrees Fahrenheit cooler. So people have known for centuries that trees work. Why don't we have more of them in cities?
Well, you know, I think they do present some challenges. For example, you know, roots underground can interfere with infrastructure, municipal infrastructure. They require a certain, you know, certain conditions to survive, a certain amount of soil, water, et cetera. That's not necessarily available in every street in the whole city. So, yeah, there can be some limitations, but I think, you know, there's many, many cities that I'm aware of that have goals to plant more trees, to increase their tree canopy cover, and they are, and they're succeeding in most cases. Obviously, incrementally, it doesn't happen overnight, but, you know, the other factor here is that a mature tree takes many years, decades, really, to mature, and so we can decide we want more trees in our cities, but this is not going to happen overnight, and so really we need to be thinking. This is one of the reasons why, even though, you know, extreme heat is already deadly and already, you know, having negative impacts, but considering that that's likely to get at least somewhat worse, we need to be proactively thinking, how can we adapt now, take steps to, for example, plant trees, such that they are mature, you know, in 20, 30 years when heat waves may be more intense.
Although I have to say, I live near a tree farm, and they are taking 20-foot-high trees and taking them out in great numbers to various cities. So it doesn't have to start from a seedling by any means. I'm wondering, can a tree strategy work in Phoenix, which already has a water shortage?
Now, that's a really key question, and that's not one that we're really diving into in this work or necessarily qualified to answer. Yeah, that's going to be a critical consideration, because trees provide more air temperature cooling in drier environments if they have enough soil water to draw from, and that's the big if. Now, there are of course other species of trees that you can use in a city like Phoenix that are more drought tolerant, you know, so they require less water. Some of them also can have very deep roots that reach the water table, very deep underground. There are, I think, in terms of shade provision, I think trees can still be quite effective in a place like Phoenix. Now, the other consideration there is, because it's a very low-density city, you know, and very automobile-centric, shade is going to provide pleasant outdoor conditions for outdoor activity like walking, cycling, et cetera, more efficiently, more effectively, the higher the density. So that's another consideration.
But trees can also slow down air movement, as you do talk about. Tell us about the balance of trees and air pollution in cities.
Yeah, that's a very complex topic, and we took a sort of a first-order approach in this work. What we looked at was the fact that trees can have a couple effects on airflow. One is they can, just by virtue of the fact that they're a barrier, they can slow down the wind. Which can, you know, obviously a lot of our automobiles are emitting pollutants near the ground, and they can prevent essentially ventilation of those pollutants. They can have another essentially negative effect on air quality, which is as they cool the air, they essentially reduce the amount of air that is diluting these pollutants, because we're no longer churning the atmosphere as much or mixing the atmosphere as much. But they can have positive impacts. So, for example, they can provide deposition surfaces, which remove pollutants from the air. And, you know, this is obviously dependent on species. It's dependent on a variety of factors, dependent on where they're planted relative to the emissions, things like this. They can also sometimes emit gaseous substances, essentially, that can contribute to the air pollution. So it's a very, you know, the impact of trees on air quality in the streets, you know, at the level that we all walk around and breathe in, is a very complex topic that we don't get into in detail. But what we wanted to do in this paper is start to get a sense of not just, you know, what's the impact of one of these heat adaptation strategies like street trees on air temperature or on outdoor thermal comfort, but we wanted to look at multiple outcomes. So we start to get a more holistic view of which strategy might be optimal.
Yes, you were looking at combinations of strategies, and your study also considers green roofs and cool roofs. Could you describe what those are?
Certainly, yeah. So cool roofs are essentially roofs primarily that are very reflective. So one way to think about this is like a typical darker roof might, in terms of how much energy is coming down from the sun, from sunlight, they might, you know, a typical dark roof might only reflect, you know, 10 or 20% of that and would absorb the rest. A cool roof or a highly reflective roof is going to reflect, you know, typically over 50% of the energy reaching it. And so it bounces, a lot of the energy bounces straight back out to space. And so that heat doesn't stay in the urban environment and heat the air and warm up the environment. Now, a green roof takes a different strategy to provide cooling. It essentially, you know, it's like taking, you know, a very simple way of thinking about it is like taking a a slice of your lawn, you know, down to maybe 10 or 15 centimeters deep and putting that on your roof. And of course, that means your roof has to be engineered for that, and, you know, roof has to be fairly flat. So it's not going to work on every building. And in fact, it's not going to work on a lot of residential buildings without being properly engineered.
Why is a roof covered in photovoltaics more effective than a green roof covered with living plants?
Yeah, that's a great question. So really here, what we're thinking about is we got to get back to this idea of multiple outcomes. So what photovoltaics do, well, they do multiple things. One is solar panels, is they generate energy, right? They generate energy that we can use for various purposes, such as heating or cooling or buildings, sending it back to the grid, et cetera. They do a couple other things. One is they shade the building. So by shading the building, they change how much, how warm it's going to get inside, and or if we're using an air conditioner, how much energy we're going to have to use to keep our building interior cool. And, you know, they also are going to have impacts on the outdoor environment. So we evaluated all those aspects in our study. And what we found is that these photovoltaic panels, what they do really well, obviously, is generate energy, generate electricity. And that can be used with the right conditions, which includes the ability to store that energy, at least over shorter periods, to cool building interiors. And so they essentially block the sun's heat from hitting the building to a certain extent, right, by covering the roof, and then they also provide energy that we can use to power our air conditioners. Now, in a more passive situation, a green roof might be more optimal if we want to, you know, not think about cooling our building interiors with air conditioners. The other factor is, you know, there's other factors that we weren't able to account for in the study, such as stormwater management, which is a major consideration for a lot of municipalities. And, you know, green roofs are going to support with that, where PV roofs aren't or solar panels aren't. So there's, you know, this is a multifactorial problem. There's lots to consider. But if we're just thinking about outcomes like we want to keep our building interior cool, solar panels are going to, you know, and we can use the energy from our solar panels to power our air conditioning units. Solar panels are going to be superior to green roofs, according to our findings to date.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, Dr. Scott Krayenhoff. We are talking about cooling cities down. For a long time, people were suggesting painting the roads white to reflect more solar energy. Why not do that?
Yeah, there's some nuance here, but the upside of doing so, and this is why it's been suggested, would be that, you know, just like the reflective roofs, you're going to bounce a lot of that energy from the sun straight back out in space, a lot of it. Now, the issue is that you can't go that high in terms of reflectivity of at the ground level, because you're going to blind people, blind drivers. We all know a highly reflective surface is blinding. Secondly, the high reflection of the sun's energy, not all of it goes straight back up to the atmosphere. Some of it's reflected more laterally towards buildings or towards, say, pedestrians. And that can actually have a negative impact on a hot day on your thermal comfort. So it can essentially, if you have a road that's painted with a high reflectivity coat of paint, it can reflect a lot of radiation towards you, towards your body, warming you, more than the actual air temperature cooling benefit in terms of your actual experience. So, and the same thing for buildings. It can reflect a lot of energy towards buildings, which can go through the windows and warm the interior. So I think these kinds of technologies need to be used carefully. If they're used away from areas where pedestrians walk and away from buildings that, you know, need a cool internal environment, I think they could still have some benefit. But otherwise, our study finds that they either don't have a great benefit, or they can actually have a bit of a negative effect on thermal comfort and building energy use for cooling.
Okay, now I may have misunderstood this, but your paper appears to claim a full implementation of street trees and solar, maybe on every possible rooftop, could actually counter the excess heat we expect as this century goes on. Can this duo really protect city dwellers from further climate heating for the rest of this century?
Yeah, again, there's a lot of nuance here, so let me try to see if I can unpack it a little bit. So I think what we're saying is, in terms of like our outdoor experience of heat, so if you're walking down the sidewalk in your city, the areas that currently don't have tree cover, if we add tree cover there, your experience of heat under that tree cover near the end of the century, so under a much warmer climate, will be lower than your experience now in the sun without any shade in extreme heat.
The new mantra is solar on every roof and trees on every street where practical. Don't waste time and money on lesser solutions if you want a livable city, and boy, do we need those. Now, how do we get this out to city planners and governments and citizens alike?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I would tend to back off from being that certain of that conclusion. Now, I think there's maybe one or more reasons why. So first, I think there's other outcomes we haven't looked at yet. So in this paper, we looked at three outcomes. We looked at the outdoor thermal environment, the indoor thermal environment, how much energy use we would need to keep that indoor thermal environment comfortable, and then air quality. Now, as I've mentioned before, we haven't factored in some other pieces like cost, like the effect on greenhouse gas emissions and therefore climate mitigation, like stormwater management, for example. So, I mean, I think there's more work to be done, and this is how science progresses. You know, we make hopefully a significant step forward, and then right now in our lab, we're already working on the next iteration of this kind of work. I think what we're saying is that I think trees and solar panels are, especially if we're considering less of a passive situation, but active cooling of interior environments, that solar panels on roofs plus trees in the streets, especially streets where air pollution is not a major concern, yeah, that's probably a pretty good solution, and there's more work to do.
In 2020, you led an article on street tree impacts on pedestrian-level climate. You've been working on urban heat solutions for years. Why? What got you into this, and why do you keep going?
Yeah, that's a great question. I go back to about 20 years ago when I was, early on in my studies, and a professor I was working with posed a question. I think he'd gotten some grant money to address this question, and the question was, if every second building roof in Toronto had a green roof, how much cooler would it be on a typical summer day in the city? And that question just fascinated me. At the time, we scarcely had the modeling tools to address questions like that. But I was fascinated by it, and I was fortunate to get some really great mentoring by one of my mentors, Alberto Martilli, who I still work with regularly, And we took a first crack at that, and we had to do some serious model development just to start to get an answer to that, because there were no green roofs in our meteorological models back then. There were scarcely urban areas represented in our meteorological models back then. So we've come a long way since then. We've been doing a lot of work, and as you mentioned, a lot of my work has been on street trees and how do we represent in these large-scale meteorological and climate models, how do we represent the effects of street trees? Because we're very good at representing forests, for example, where it's just trees, or we're reasonably good at representing in these models just buildings and roads. But as soon as you plant trees, now your trees are shading your buildings are shading your trees are shading your roads, and they're sheltering each other from the wind, and there's all kinds of interactions. And so that's, we've been working on trying to capture some of these interactions that are actually quite significant if you want to understand how trees are going to affect your local climate in the city.
From Guelph, Canada, we've been speaking with Dr. Scott Krayenhoff, co-author of the new paper, Prioritizing Urban Heat Adaptation Infrastructure, based on multiple outcomes, comfort, health, and energy. And that is published in PNAS, May 5th, 2025. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Scott, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thanks very much, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's all for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about the world.
Suns are blazing like a thousand suns. Heat's arising, no place to run. Sweat drips down, feels like I'm on fire. Burning up, can't cool this desire. Shadows gone, nowhere to hide. Thermometer's broke, climb too high. Air's so heavy, it's hard to breathe. Praying for rain, some sort of reprieve. Heatwave blues can't escape the heat. Dancing in the sun on burning concrete. Heatwave blues, no relief in sight. Dangerous day. Sweltering nights, AC's busted, it's hotter inside. Fans spin slow like the heat's worldwide. Ice melting fast in my glass of tea. Time's crawling by in this misery. Look up to the sky, hope for a breeze. Wish for a cloud, bringing some ease.
We're going into uncharted territories that are more analogous to some of the most disruptive events in Earth's history that cause massive warming and sometimes extinction events.
Going downhill, 90 miles an hour. I said hit the brakes, you said hit the accelerator. Accelerator. Accelerator.